Hello, I'm James Sandy, and this is the New Curiosities Box, a choice slice of arts and culture from Birmingham and beyond. In this programme, we carefully open the box on a well-established classic as it is presented in vivid new light by way of a catch-up with some of the cast from the National Theatre's production of Jane Eyre at the Rep in Birmingham. We seek out more things with strings as I speak to the leading protagonists behind the flexible jazz swing combo, fret and fiddle, and there's a roundup of events and culture to mark out in your velvet pocketbook. For more information and links on all the shows to date, you can check out our blog, thenewcuriositiesbox.blogspot.co.uk. We start with a glorious production of Jane Eyre, cutting deep to the heart of the novel's potent themes and translating them into an engaging, moving production. Sally Cookson's production fixes contemporary sights on this 170-year-old tale of identity and equality, underlined with contemporary music and demanding stage architecture. I caught up with Hannah Bristow and Matthew Churcher from the cast to help me get a handle of this giant of our culture.
Okay, so I'm hiding out at the Rep this time with a beautiful view of a roundabout in Birmingham, and I'm really excited to be talking about the current production at the Rep of Jane Eyre, okay, which is fantastic. I saw it on Monday night this week, and I was genuinely kind of enthralled by it. So I'm pleased to be here with Hannah and Matt, and you've got interesting roles in the production, and I wanted to start, if I could, about, I suppose, the challenge of Jane Eyre. Okay, we'll talk a little bit about your sort of individual elements that you add to the production. But Jane Eyre is one of those kind of classics that it's quite dangerous, isn't it, to interpret or to go near. I mean, how accessible is it, do you think, in terms of approaching it?
Well, I think pretty much everyone has encountered Jane Eyre in some way or another, probably before they come and see the show, whether they've seen the Michael Fassbender film or read the book at school. It's so everyone comes to it with like some kind of emotional connection to it, I think. And I think we're aware, or the original company who devised it were very aware of like dealing with that and how to innovate while also staying true to what the core of the novel is.
But people, you're right, people do, I think, have a lot of preconceptions about what it should look like or how it should perhaps be, portrayed, you know. And it's quite, I guess it's quite an intricate book as well, which makes it even more sort of complicated. But this production, I think, first started sort of 2014, I think. It kind of grew out of the Bristol Old Vic and has been sort of touring in various places since. And I'm interested in terms of the acting process, how you kind of come at a production like this. Because for folks that have come to see the play and should come to see the play, it looks fantastic, but it looks very different. It's not what you expect. From start to finish, it's not what you expect. So the process for developing, I mean, it didn't start with scripts, I don't think, did it?
No. So that was the original company, which was a different company of actors, but with the same director, Sally Cookson. And they worked from devising, I think, and they had a general outline of what they wanted the production to be. They had, like, the scenes that they thought would probably be in the production, and they improvise them, and then it was Mike Akers, is that the writer in the room, who then put that down on paper and made a script, and they edited until they got initially two productions. It was a two-play show, and then it was distilled for its performance at the National last year.
Don't fact-check with me.
Now, also, Matt, people will come to this, and to be really clear, it's not a musical production of Jane Eyre.
No.
But their music defines the production in a lot of ways. The music's used, I think, very cleverly to underline some of the kind of the narrative and the theme.
Precisely.
And on the stage itself, and there is a trio of musicians, kind of, it almost looks like hiding under a table, but that doesn't do it justice. But you very cleverly, I think, apply colour to the stage. What I'm trying to get to is how you apply the music and the right music for the mood of the play. How did you come to that?
Well, that is down to the wonderful mind of Benji Bauer, who's the composer. He's kind of created this beautiful score along with Sally and Dan and the rest of the creative team and the company in the room as part of the devising process. So he'll sit there and play whilst the actors are improvising scenes, and work from there. So they're both informing each other. And then yet again, when it comes into a full production, it's distilled down from what you've discovered in the moment into what you hear. It's really almost a cinematic score to help aid the piece. It's not like a detracting feature. It's not like now a musical number, like you say. It's not a musical. It's to kind of combine with the story of Jane, because it's all about her journey through life, and so the music is there just to help lift and push the story along. It's another creative element, I suppose.
That's interesting you say that. I was going to describe the musical bits as wallpaper, but I don't think that does it justice. I think it's more about landscape, isn't it? And one of the really interesting things I found is that the musicians, including yourself, have parts in the play as well, in the production, in the sense that you kind of blend in, you know. So the music, therefore, is something part and parcel of all of the scenes and all of the sort of acts, rather than, you know, they're just being a musical bit, an acting bit, you know.
It was the term that someone used recently, was that crucible is kind of the way the music works. They're kind of in the middle physically, and also the way it's kind of intertwined throughout everything we're doing, and that really can like lift your performance as well as an actor. You like the music is helping you feel the things that you need to be feeling for the show,
and vice versa. We're responding to the actors on stage, and that's informing how we're playing as well.
And they're improvising most of the time, or lots of the time. They're like adding things and taking things away, and depending on what's happening in the show. So it's always fresh.
And there's some very strong themes in Jane Eyre, and that sort of is a bit of an understatement, I think. Now, it's a novel, I guess it is a novel, really, that is 170-odd years old, I think, or, you know, I think this year is its 100...
Trust you or not,
yeah. Something like that, yeah, trust me or not. But its themes, really, you know, it talks about a number of things, but and it's mentioned in some of the literature supporting the production, that this is an autobiography, effectively. This is the story of a girl, of a woman, okay? And through that story, it's, you know, there's a real theme of equality, isn't there? You know, kind of Jane herself, you know, many occasions shouts about, you know, things being unfair and unjust. And just, you know, those themes, I think, resonate perhaps more so now, when, you know, where we are in the 21st century. But to me, it helped sort of reawaken the importance of those things, of equality and of, you know, of kind of gender equality and women's rights. I wonder what sort of, what elements of that perhaps, you know, you took from the production.
Well, yeah, because it's, those questions are still there in a different way. And so the things that Jane's fighting against and the obstacles that Jane has in her story are different to the obstacles that we have in gender equality questions now. But those questions, like, the story isn't finished. We haven't, like, solved that problem. And it's talking about that. I think it's also interesting in that it is a modern take on a classical text. And so within that, you have to look at questions like the Rochester question and the issue of imprisoning your wife in the attic. From a modern perspective, I don't think there's, from any perspective really, there's any way to justify that. And so I think what this production does fantastically is really elevate Bertha, his wife in the attic, and give her a voice in a way that I don't even think the original novel did. So yeah, it reapproaches that from a modern perspective and thinking about women's voices in a 21st century way, I think.
And there is something, I think, you know, fundamentally there are themes, there are questions in the story about truth. Okay, so there's something at the back of my mind about, you know, how truthful is a recollection of the kind of lead character's, you know, sort of idea of what's happening. And that's not 100 miles away from the kind of fake news kind of things that we have to encounter on a day-to-day basis. And I think, interestingly, in this production, Bertha Mason is, you know, in the book she's perhaps described as a lunatic. That's the phrase, which is, you know, not particularly well used these days, thankfully. But she's more of a siren, and she's more of a kind of conscience character, I think, in some ways. And what works for me, what works brilliantly in this production is, you know, those psychological and physical barriers, you know, are really quite stark, but very much intertwined. You know, you've got, I don't want to spoil it for people, but you've got a point where, you know, you start and finish at the same point. You know, it's the it's a girl moment, you know. And I wonder how, in terms of the physical space, in terms of that, you know, you'd have to see the stage. I mean, there's some good pictures on the Rep website and in other places, but physically, that, you know, my theory is it's a birdcage. That's my theory of the what the set is. But I wondered how easy it is to use the set to kind of explore perhaps some of those themes.
I think the idea that the where that came from originally is that Sally was speaking in the design meetings about obstacles again, and the question of building those obstacles, and she wanted it to be physically difficult. Mm. It's specifically meant to be hard, and it's physically difficult. We do a lot of running, we climb a lot of ladders. You can see her sweating, and that is very much part of the story. It's about her struggle. And yeah, and so there's a platform, there's a long gantry at the back, there's 7 ladders, the stage has quite a heavy rake. So yeah, it's all about containment and potentially a birdcage as well.
Mm. It's a wonderful gift as an actor being able to have that to play with, because you are having to go through the motions, which informs your journey and your character. Mm. I think with the set designer was talking about it on our kind of opening day or second day in rehearsals, said, you know, you can just climb up a ladder as a ladder, or you can imbue that with the kind of energy it takes to scale an actual obstacle. Mm. Which I think is kind of a wonderful thing, and the audience really get to see that effort.
There was a point when I was watching the production where I thought, well, that looks quite wobbly. I was quite worried for some of the, yourselves and some of the other actors. But and then I thought, oh my God, there's fire now at the back.
I thought
wooden set, fire, probably, not the greatest mix. But yeah, really interesting how, in some ways, it felt quite claustrophobic in terms of that it's a huge stage, but you've got quite not limited space, but you've got a kind of compartmentalised. Mm. Aspect of it, and that, it came across, I think, really well, that kind of the sort of physical restraint, if you like. Mm. Mm. Now also, you mentioned there are lots of different versions of Jane Eyre through history. For me, some of this is about there's something about belief in this as well, isn't there? I'd be interested in your take on this. There's something about not just religious belief, but there's something about sort of institutional faith, i.e. people sort of subscribing to bits of the state that maybe they don't understand, but then perhaps also they then espouse some of those values themselves without realising it. They kind of create new sort of restrictions. Certainly, Hannah, you play a number of different roles in the production, and I have to say, one thing I was going to say is your accents are fantastic. Okay, so having lived in Newcastle for a while, I can just about discern a Northumberland from a Geordie accent, from a Wearside accent, and you did it very well. So,
Thank you very much. That's
a string to your bow, as you were. And also the French accent, okay? Now French is a notoriously difficult language to master. And you did very well with that as well, particularly as well, I should add for listeners, that you were playing a French child, okay? So that's another dimension, isn't it, to it? But I wondered, in terms of lots of different productions of it, how difficult is it to get a balance between doing something different for artistic reasons versus doing something different just because you're doing something different? Do you see what I mean?
What, because of doing something different for the length of the run, do you mean? Or
So it's a classic. It's a classic book, it's a classic novel, and people, as I said, would have an idea fixed in their mind of what it should look like, and some of that's there in terms of the costumes and the design to a point of the time. But I wondered how easy it is to modernise it, I suppose, and it is a fairly modern production, isn't it?
Yeah, I think, I don't know, it links back to what you were saying before, really. I think there's a problem posed in the novel that isn't solved, and I think the novel's quite clear about that. It's like, there's difficulties and there's problems, and Jane spends a lot of her time trying to work out where she fits in that, whether to subscribe to society or reject society, and where we can find happiness. And I think that question's always there, so I don't think that's necessarily, it's arbitrary, the modernisation. I think it's, those same questions are still there. I don't know if you agree, Matt, but those questions are there, and we've just reapproached them.
There are some strands, I think, that are kind of timeless, aren't they? Kind of the perpetual kind of questions about the human condition, if you like, aren't they? We just talk about the music a bit more as well, because the musical score, if I can call it that, is really interesting, I think, because it kind of knock me over for saying this, but it kind of comes from a sort of Gershwin quarter, I think, in some ways. It's a kind of jazz and blues mix or kind of infusion, and an aspect of it is kind of Creole as well, and that, I think that kind of links to the particular kind of characterization of Bertha Mason, if you like. Now, I was fascinated as we got to the end of the production, by the use of Crazy as a song.
Yeah.
The Gnarls Barkley song. And I thought, have I missed something here? is this a classic song that Gnarls Barkley found? Mm. And I thought, no, it's not. It's a Gnarls Barkley song. So that's a very modern piece. But amazingly, it translates and it works.
Mm.
So, I mean, how sort of, you know, that must be quite a dangerous thing to stick in, if you like.
I suppose it's a tricky one, because that will, using any well-known song or modern song, people will instantly have their own take on it, or have their own associations, because music does that.
Yeah,
you kind of get transported back to where you heard that song, or your first like love is linked for that song. So it's a tough one. So all of the songs are composed by Benji, bar three, which is Crazy. There's also Mad About the Boy, and also there's an Elvis number, My Jesus Knows, as well.
Which yes,
no one really kind of gets that.
I'm glad you mentioned that. Yeah.
But Crazy, so stripped back the way it is, so it's very soft and sung beautifully by Mel.
And slowed down a lot.
Yeah, it's very kind of sparse and slow and like kind of sensual.
And lyrical, yeah.
The words say everything.
Mm.
And I think they played it in rehearsals, and why try write something else when the lyrics are so perfect for her situation and Jane's situation, and that sort of aspect of mentality and life and the kind of the collision of the two.
Yeah, I think it is like astounding how appropriate the lyrics are.
Mm.
For a song which is very much like the song you'd dance to in a club to, it's astounding when you slow it down and you listen to the words. It's talking about mental health and like what is madness and what does it mean to be mad. Well, if I'm crazy, you're crazy too. And and again, it's that thing we were talking about with the gender question in it. It gives birth to that voice which she is denied in the novel. And I think it's astounding that a song that is that song and that has those personal associations for so many people really fits.
There's more from Hannah and Matt in the last section of the show. Now, if you're searching for a musical interlude to recharge your soul and sort out your thinking, well, stay tuned. I caught up with Sally Minchin and Andy Bowl of Expanding Quintet Fret and Fiddle as they prepared to shower a captivated audience with insight, improvisation, and intelligent jazz-lensed swing.
Okay, so I'm excitedly in the Hexagon Theatre here at the Mac with Sally and Andy of Fret and Fiddle. And I think I've got that right.
Yes.
Now, for the listeners at home, let's start with Fret and Fiddle. Sounds like something you could get arrested for. But let's be clear what it is. It's a quintet or a sextet?
How
many folks have you got in your ensemble?
Tonight there's four of us. We're a quartet tonight because it's such an intimate setting. But at the moment, we're a lineup of five of us, so we're a quintet generally with drums as well. But we thought we'd do a little bit more of an acoustic thing tonight without the drums for this theatre, because it's so lovely, Bernie, and it's nice and compact as well. So that's what, between us and the Mac, that's what was agreed.
And you've got a kind of sort of jazz, swing, folk portfolio, is that fair, or is
that's
it?
Well, we lean more towards the swing and jazz of the 1920s, 30s, and our big inspiration is the Hot Club de France and Stefan Grappelli, especially. He's one of my heroes. So that was the inspiration for the band, was Django Reinhardt, the amazing, legendary gypsy guitarist, and for me, of course, Stefan Grappelli. So that's what we're based on. But then among that, we like to throw in some blues. Andy's got a lot of experience in the blues world, and less of the folk element, but there is a little tinge of that
there's
there
a vibe,
as well. Yeah, there's a vibe of that there. Yeah.
And it's a Birmingham band, isn't it? It's a Birmingham sort of creation.
Yep.
Which
yep.
is exciting. So I think you've been together in one way or another since about 2001, is that about
yeah,
right?
Yeah, 2001, 2002. Yeah. We started off as a duo, didn't we? Yes. Yeah.
Expanded, and the rest is history, as they
expanded
say.
To a trio for a while.
Yeah, we worked as a trio for some years and won some awards as well, which was great, and got quite a built up a name for ourselves. And then we sort of come back at it with the quartet and the quintet. We've been playing quite recently, doing a Grappelli swing project, which is telling the story of the life of Stefan Grappelli. So that's another show that we do.
And that's quite an onus, isn't it, really? It's quite a sort of a big thing to take on, because these are big names. You know,
absolutely.
Django Reinhardt, Stefan Grappelli, these are big name. So are you kind of, are you carefully wiring these things? Are you,
No, I think it's our own take on things, really. Mm. I think they inspired us, but it's not note for note.
No, it's like
they did it.
It's like our version, isn't it? Yeah. Our interpretation, and they like that's the flavour of the work. But then we bring a lot of our own ideas to the band, so
it's
a little bit different.
It's not just Grappelli. It's we throw in. We've got a Tom Waits song.
Yeah.
Oh, I read that. Now, also, I read that you have a Leonard Cohen song.
That's right.
We do.
In your repertoire. Yeah. Now, I don't know which song that is. So which?
That's Dance Me to the End of Love.
Now that is a very beautiful and tragic song in many ways. If anyone listening ever looks at the history of that song and what it's actually about and what it focuses on, it's quite chilling in some.
It is.
In some ways, isn't it? So you've got quite a mix in terms of what you approach and what you play. What sort of things are you trying to explore when you sort of interpret things? How do you come to them? What I mean by that is what sort of things are driving you? Obviously a love of music and a love of those traditions, but are there particular things that you want to sort of, you know, particular avenues you want to take it down? Or
I think there's a lot of improvisation in the music, so I think it's just where it goes on the night. It can go anywhere.
Yeah, and I think, well, I think long term, we're just trying to bring some of our own individual personalities, aren't we, to this amazing era of music that it's quite wide, you know, broad encompassing stuff. And we're trying to bring some of our own personalities into that and just create something that people from any background and any musical taste can come and listen to us, and they don't need to be a jazz, you know, fanatic or someone who's just into folk or just into blues. It can be someone who actually just likes classical music can come to our shows and say, actually, I'm not really keen on jazz, but I've really enjoyed that. And we get that kind of feedback all the time. So it really is a band for everyone. And that's what we try and portray in what we do, you know, make it fun. We like to have a good chat and a banter with the audience and bring in something for everyone, really.
And presumably that innovation, that improvisation is very much determined by where you are, I guess, you know, in terms of the different settings, different environments. Is it tricky? Do you turn up to places and think, oh, I'm not sure about, you know, I'm not sure what kind of mood we're in tonight here?
I don't think any of that really comes into the space you're playing. Mm. I mean, I think audiences help.
Yes.
You know, the feedback from the audience.
Yes, if you've got a frosty audience.
If you've got a lot of grumpy people looking at you.
You don't have grumpy people at gigs.
Not here, obviously.
No, not here. But I mean, if they're scowling at you, you think, this is a bit hard.
I think they warm, though, don't they? Sometimes you get somewhere and you look, and perhaps the audience aren't used to that kind of a music or that kind of a band, and you're thinking, where's this going to go? And pretty much by the end of every gig, isn't it? Everyone's really like coming up saying, we loved it, it's amazing. And yeah, but I'd say definitely we play at a lot of different venues. So there is an element to, like, we sculpt the pieces to suit the venue to a point. We don't lose our own, you know, personal style, but we say, right, okay, we're playing in a church, it's a different acoustic. It's perhaps a different set of people than we normally play for. Mm. So we might be sensitive to, you know, our surroundings in that way. But yes. it's essentially the same.
So it's kind of tailored stuff, I guess, in terms of where you are.
And I guess what mood we're in as well. Sometimes we do things differently, don't we? Like, well, we just felt like throwing that in the moment. It's really exciting.
Thank you. Let's talk a little bit about what you play and what you do in the group, as it were. Now, Sally, you're a violinist, I think, aren't you?
That's right.
I was going to say you're a fiddler.
Oh, but that's fine as well. Yes.
But there is a sort of there's a slight difference between a fiddle and a violin. I think only a slight one, but the violin's very much your weapon, isn't it?
It is. I was classically trained at the conservatoire, and so the whole improvising world and the non-classical repertoire, really, even though I always loved that came to me after I finished my degree. And so I started experimenting with singing some blues and playing some blues with Andy, and then we just took it on from there, and we did some of the Grappelli stuff, and it was a big learning curve. It was something I never actually trained in, but it's something that I've picked up from other professional musicians once I'd left the conservatoire. So it's been a very exciting time for me career-wise, because I still play classically as well, and the singing's been a great adventure for me to have that freedom of expression with my voice as well as my instrument. So yeah.
Now, Andy, you're a strings man of a different kind, aren't you? You're a guitarist.
Guitarist,
but
mainly.
You play other things as well.
I play a little bit of banjo, some bouzouki.
And how difficult is it? You know, Django Reinhardt famously sort of has a style that's impossible, I think, to sort of imitate.
Yeah, I think it was just a one-off. There's plenty of people trying to play like
a bit
that.
Like Nick Drake, for example. You know, no one can ever tune a guitar like Nick Drake.
No.
You know, never quite worked out what he was up to.
That's right.
So, presumably, did you come a classical route, or did you...
I started off as a student doing classical guitar, but really I left that world and became an avant-garde sort of psychedelic rock guitarist for most of my life.
Was that a choice you made at the crossroads, you know, trying to meet the man, that kind of thing?
Yeah, sold my soul to the devil.
Off on the way. Now, let's talk about the album that you've got out at the moment, which I think is called Je Tendre.
That's correct.
My French isn't great, but it's a kind of, folks listening, some folks will know that song itself is a kind of traditional French song, which is akin to We'll Meet Again.
I think the French version is something like I Will Wait. I think it translates, you know, the sort of some of the lyrics translates as I Will Wait. But it actually originated as an Italian popular song.
Interesting.
And I think that was You Will Return, something like that. So the translation got a little bit mixed up, you know, in the process. But it's written about in 1933, that one, I think. And it was just literally an Italian popular song that became so popular through those pre-Second World War years. And then throughout, it was just everybody was just playing this on their gramophones and dancing to it. And it became very emblematic of the Second World War, actually.
So is that a theme for the album? Does that kind of set the tone of the album?
I think it's just because at the time it was a new one to us. So we were playing it and really getting into it. And it marks the start of a new era with the Grappelli project and with the bringing in the drums into the band. And so we've changed so much over the years that it was like, you know, iconic for us, that song. Really, it just trips along really nicely, and it's really it's got a great vibe to it as well.
And as you're making an album, or you know, you're recording, and what you've described is a sort of a band that's growing and developing and changing, perhaps changing where it is as well, as much as kind of who's in it at different stages. Is an album quite difficult to put together, in a sense that
there's a lot of decisions about not only what's on it, but what order the songs go in. I think it's quite vital the way it runs as an album. So it's, you know, before you go into a studio to record, you record a lot more than you actually put out, but then it's a decision making time.
And then you've got a very difficult decision, I guess, in terms of what you leave.
What you leave out,
Well, the other thing we get is, because we record live, because of the improvisation and everything, so we're not separating and layering, you know, different channels on top of each other, but we're literally going in the studio and we have to play a really good take, otherwise we can't really use it. And so we'll record several versions of the same tune, and inevitably something special and different will be on each of those, so we have to figure out between us and argue between us, right, which take do we like the best of that track. And that's, you know, been quite entertaining at home, hasn't it, when we've been in the mixing process and going, right, which one we're going to use. And we've sometimes experimented in the studio and recorded different introductions, different endings. We've experimented, even like nothing's totally 100% set with us, is it? We're always evolving. So then that makes of another difficult decision, because a lot of it's quite subjective, really.
I think we probably recorded, I don't know, 6 or 7 versions of each thing on the album, so it's a decision. It's hard.
It's really tricky, isn't it?
And presumably when you're in the studio, you're together collectively in the same space, are you?
Yeah.
Or are you,
yeah,
not, you don't do the sort of Captain Beefheart thing of separating people throughout the house.
I'd love to do that personally, but no, we don't.
We separated me, I think, on this album, didn't we? I was in a separate.
She was in a booth.
With the violin.
But it wasn't done on different.
No, we were all days. Recording at the same time.
There was nobody coming in and replacing parts. No. It was just recorded.
It's different. Live. I guess a difficult dynamic, really, isn't it? In terms of, you know, when you have something that's very focused on flow and improvisation, and you know, very much a kind of, you know, sort of sparking off each other. There's a danger you separate those things out, isn't there? When you go into the studio, you know, many bands have kind of fallen foul of, you know, sort of, well, we'll record that a bit separately, or it didn't quite sound right. You know?
Yeah,
I think we've tried that in the past, though, haven't we? And it never really quite
it doesn't work as far as I'm concerned. I've spent months in studios trying to hone down a certain part, and it's always inevitable. You go back to the beginning and think, well, that one I recorded on the first day was the best one.
That was okay.
So you're out and about doing lots of gigs and lots of different venues. What sort of things have you got coming up? You've done some festivals, and I think you've got some other things coming up.
We've done some festivals. We've got quite a lot of stuff coming up in next year. We've got a few dates. We've got the local one in Sutton Coldfield on the 3rd of Feb. We've got various dates that we'll definitely give out this evening. And we're playing in some venues in Staffordshire and... What are we doing? Can't remember now. All over the place. We're travelling, further distances as well. So we're going down to Devon to Kingsbridge Jazz Club and up to Boston in the Spa to play there as well.
Worcester.
Yeah. So all over the place.
So you're really charging up the camper van, are you? Is that you?
We are, absolutely. Well, we've got on our website, we've got a list of all our dates, haven't we? And on our Facebook page as well. So we keep that regularly updated with all what we're up to.
Excellent. Well, I should encourage folk to check those places out. So just give us your web address, just so we know where to go.
Yes, that's www.fretandfiddle.co.uk.
Okay, well, I shall be along for the gig later. I'm looking forward to it immensely. You're sounding good through the door, so that's always good.
That's always a good sign.
You sound even better okay. when we get to the performance. So for now, Sally and Andy, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
More now from Hannah and Matt from the cast of Jane Eyre.
There's something about time in the production and how time progresses, okay? And it's not uniform, it seems to be quite erratic. And what I mean by that is, there are chunks of Jane Eyre's life that we're sort of exposed to at different rates. Mm. And potentially you could get a bit lost in that, but you're never confused, which is good. And there's a wonderful way, I think, and perhaps you can tell me a little bit more about this, there's a wonderful way that the passing of time is conveyed. Mm. And that's this kind of sort of stomping, running along bit where people are kind of travelling on carriage or horseback or whatever, but it kind of conveys the passing of time. And I just wondered what as a vehicle for doing that, what your thoughts are on that?
I think, a lot of that is down to the choreographer, Dan Canham, and it's about the physical storytelling of the piece, and a lot of the storytelling is physical, and it's not... The script is relatively sparse for the story that we're telling, and a lot of it is, as you say, conveyed in... There's some moments where we're sewing, for example, and to show that is a number of days, we'll stand up and we'll just drift and move into a different position. So time is passing, but the same things are happening, and... Yeah, it has to be in the way you say, because a lot of it is same. Like, Jane's life goes on and is same every day in lots of points in her life, and that's what she's grappling with, that she's discontent with this, like, monotony. And so, it's trying to portray that in a way that is engaging for an audience, and that's the way that Dan has done it. And the carriage section is of that issue of journeying and obstacles is one of the most dynamic moments of the play, because it's about change and going to a new place, and the boys have... got lots of drums going
and it's shouting out our place names. Yeah,
it's about journeying and moving and change.
Epic journey of it.
Yeah.
Have you seen slight tangent, but Lady Macbeth?
Yes, I have.
Film, and there's one of the opening shots is just that repetition of her getting dressed, sitting down in the room, and kind of waiting. There's nothing for her to do, but you get that. So it's such a still image, but it's unrelenting in its kind of time and monotony of it that. I think as an audience it's really palpable. You get exactly what that is in a couple of shots or a few seconds of scene. You're like, okay, right, I get what the life is. I get the feeling. I get the frustration that's born out of that.
Yeah, I think, and also this play, in the way it's been devised, is quite filmic. It's shots, and we have these still images and moments which we then switch to for another one, and that is done through the choreography and the running around the space to tackle that very problem you say, which is the movement of time.
Now your colleague Paul Mundell.
Mundell, yeah.
Yeah, who he plays a number of characters. Now, really interestingly, he plays Mr. Brocklehurst, who, if folks don't know Jane Eyre, is essentially a kind of authoritarian Ulster school teacher / preacher. But he also plays a dog. He plays a dog called Pilot.
He does play a dog called Pilot.
But that sort of describing it in that way kind of belittles it, because he's quite amazing in terms of how he conveys the kind of caricature of a dog. Mm. And I think there's more to it than that. And I think it's not by accident that he plays those two roles. You know, there is this thing about church and state and about subservience and those kind of things. But I'm guessing that there was probably, you know, a point where the cast were gathered together and said, who's going to play the dog? And maybe, did Paul get the short straw? I don't know. Maybe he got the long straw. I don't know, but...
I think it's
everyone loves the dog.
Loves the dog.
Like, I think Paul has won, really. And also the fact that he's so brilliant at it is just a double win for Paul. The way it was cast was actually that Sally made that call before that it was decided. She was like, this man will play Brocklehurst and the dog and etc. And and that's just that has been given to Paul Mundell, who plays a brilliant dog. And as in the roles that you've described, I play the little French girl. And I get to spend a lot of time with Pilot the dog, and it's a complete and utter joy. Because, it's like, he is a dog for those moments on stage, and it's fab. Really, really fab.
And just to finish, I'm just conscious of your time. You're kind of, you know, busy people in the theatre, I know. Busy. There's something about Adele, the character you play, which struck me about sort of change and cultural change. There are a number of references to how things are being influenced or, you know, in some people's minds... tainted. Okay, so there's this idea that you cannot speak French because you can only speak French in France, you know, it's that kind of thing.
Or yeah.
There's this idea later on in the piece where the missionary describes, you know, needing to speak Hindustani, you know, because he won't have any influence. And there's these kind of really kind of quite clever markers throughout. But you know, I just wondered, it sort of, again, it comes back to, you know, the relevance now of Jane Eyre, in that it does not only you know, some of those things about time and marking time, but it does help, again, think, or help us think about those cultural shifts that, you know, and certainly the last 170 years have been massive. I just wondering your reflections on that.
For Adele, I think the struggle she has is that she is literally lifted out of a world she knows entirely, in which she's, I think, like, kind of lavished upon. And, in, like, it's in Paris and there's beautiful things around her all the time, and she's dropped into middle of rural England where it's dark and there's a man who shouts at her. For a child like that to be, like, incredibly out of place, it's kind of similar to Jane, feeling othered and feeling different. And, yeah, I think all the characters feel that in a slightly different way, but especially the women in it. So, yeah, I think that answers your question about, yeah, it approaches that thing of feeling separate and different, and I guess which isn't... we don't get now because we have a greater sense of globalisation. For her, like, France is an impossibility away. She's not going to go back there. In the same way that India is, like, inconceivably, impossibly far away for St. John when he goes away. So the play is in some ways talking about that isolation, which is really time-specific.
There are always lots of deep angles to plays. And, you know, part of my challenge is to say to people that these are really accessible pieces of work. And I think, you know, it's tribute to everyone in the production that it's enthralling. It is. You sit there for 3 hours, best part of 3 hours, and it's like, wow, this is like a film, but I'm in it, you know. And it's kind of, I think that's a great, you know, again, that's a very sort of trite review, but it's, you know, it's a very sort of cinematic production. It is very immediate and very, very instant. So congratulations on that. And it plays here at the Birmingham Rep until the 16th of September. So folks have still got time to catch it. But you're moving on to Hull, I think, next.
Indeed.
City of Culture.
City
of Culture. Where else you could go? And then I think you're finishing at the Littleton Theatre, which is the National Theatre, after that, so towards the end of the year. And then, obviously, you can have a bit of a breather and move on to whatever comes next.
Indeed.
So for now, Hannah and Matt, thank you very much. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you for yours.
Thank you.
For more information, videos and podcasts from the National Theatre, go to nationaltheatre.org.uk/digital. And for more listings, information and upcoming productions at the Rep, go to birmingham-rep.co.uk. Pencils to the ready for some intriguing upcoming events. On Sunday the 8th of October at the Mac from 11 o'clock in the morning, you can take the kids for some craftivism as part of the Women and Protest season to create some solidarity bunting. On Tuesday the 17th of October at 6:30 p.m, an evening with broadcaster, philanthropist and voice of the people, June Sarpong, at Waterstones in Birmingham. On Saturday the 21st of October at 6:30 p.m, Be the Change, part of the Fierce Festival Takeover, will take place in the Edwardian Tea Room in Birmingham Museum and Art Gallery, you can catch a group of artists, playwrights and protesters mixing up more things than just a cup of tea. And now it's time to close the box. You can check out our blog, thenewcuriositiesbox.blogspot.co.uk, for more links and information on the featured content, as well as an archive of our shows so far. My thanks to the Rep Birmingham, Fret and Fiddle and Mac Birmingham for their support in making this programme. Theme music by Morgan TJ. The New Curiosities Box is written and produced by me, James Sandy, and is a King of the Buttons production for Switch Radio.